Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast series Hate Crime on the Two Islands.
This project seeks to explore key aspects of the law reform processes with respect to hate crime that are occurring in England and Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Ireland. My name is Mark Walters and I'm a Professor of Criminal Law and Criminology at the University of Sussex, and with me is my colleague and co-host Professor Jennifer Schwepp, who is an Associate Professor at the University of Limerick.
With our special guests each week who bring a fresh perspective to the issue, we explore themes and developments across our two islands to inform debate and practice.
Hello everyone and welcome to the podcast series Hate Crime on the Two Islands. The project seeks to explore key aspects of law reform processes with respect to hate crime that are occurring in England and Wales, Ireland, Northern Ireland and Scotland. My name is Mark Walters and I'm a Professor of Criminal Law and Criminology at the University of Sussex. And with me is my colleague and co-host Professor Jennifer Schwepp, who is newly appointed Associate Professor at the University of Limerick.
So in today's session, we look at the very complex question of how the law can respond to the growing problem of online hate. And with us to discuss this topic is one of the leading experts in this field of study, Cara Bakalis, who is a principal lecturer at Oxford Brookes University. And along with Cara, we have Paul Giannassi, who is the police hate crime policy lead at the National Police Chiefs Council, which covers all nations in the United Kingdom, where he is also the lead on the National Online Hate Crime Hub. Welcome to you both. Okay, so let's get straight into it, shall we?
Yes.
I'm throwing this question out to either you, Cara, or Paul. What do we mean when we refer to online hate crime? What does it actually encompass?
So what is online, I think, is the first question, isn't it? What do we mean when we talk about online?
So I guess online, we are specifically here talking, in most cases, really about social media. Although, of course, it's not going to be just social media comments that we are referring to. We'll also be referring to comments that might be sent in emails or potentially over text messages or on things like WhatsApp groups and so on. There's no real definition as such as anything that we might see as somehow being communicated by an electronic network of some sort.
So for us in policing, we would say that it's any crime that has an element where it's been committed online. And as Cara says, this isn't really just online. The link between media, social media and traditional media is interchangeable. It is about where the crime is committed through speech. So it's not really criminalising the speech, it's criminalising the action that's contained within the speech, whether that be inciting racial hatred, whether it be threatening to kill, whether it be outraging public decency. It's an offence where it's committed online, and obviously hate crime in this instance. So it covers an absolute massive spectrum of activity, from somebody who is plotting to encourage people to go out and commit terrorist offences or violent offences, through to people using threatening language in a row over whether a goal was offside in a football match.
So obviously cyber hate or online hate is quite a broad concept, isn't it? Would you distinguish between online hate crime and online hate speech? Would you say they're two of the same things?
I would probably make a distinction between the two, and I think different considerations are in play. So I would say hate speech is speech that's not necessarily directed at a particular individual, but is speech that's directed at groups of people and is demonstrating some kind of hostility towards those groups or trying to stir up hatred in some way. Whereas online hate crime is, in my mind, is offences that we might be quite used to offline, so things like assault or harassment or anything like that, that happens to be targeting a particular individual. So that would be one way, I think, of potentially of seeing the two as being slightly separate. I think the reason why I would deal with them slightly separately is because I think that when we are thinking about legislation, we need to distinguish between offences that are aimed at individual people and offences that aimed at groups. So that's the, that's one distinction I can make.
And I concur. I mean, it isn't illegal to use hateful speech. The Article 10 of the Human Rights Framework protects free speech, including the right to offend. And there's been a number of cases that have been to the European Court where the court have said that the right to free speech doesn't extend to the right to incite hatred against groups or to rewrite history in the case of Holocaust denial. So it's about the hate speech is perhaps a much broader circle, and hate crime is that hate speech that crosses the legal threshold into a criminal offence in the country where it's perpetrated. So for me, they're interchangeable, but as Cara says, it's right to say there is a distinction because one is illegal and the other one might not be.
So can I ask then, just because I think it's really useful for us to clarify where the boundaries are before we start talking about is it a problem and how do we solve it if it is, or how do we address it through the criminal law if it is? We'll never solve it, I don't think. So on the one hand, if we take criminal speech, so that is carve-outs from Article 10, so we're talking incitement to hatred, incitement to terrorism, those sorts of offences. On the other hand then, Cara, what you're saying is we have crimes which are on the statute book which just happen to be committed either using some sort of electronic internet device, your phone, your computer, and then everything else is what we call awful but lawful. You know, that everything below those two thresholds. And so if we say that there are those two categories, broad categories, and correct me if I'm wrong, those two broad categories of criminality or criminal offences that happen online, is everything else acceptable then?
I think that's a really, really good question. And I think that's something that here in the UK, we're thinking about quite specifically in relation to the Online Safety Bill and thinking about the regulator that is going to be set up here in the UK. And I think I'd make a distinction here between what we might say is acceptable to say offline and online. I think it may well be that in terms of what we are happy for people to say in the offline world, you know, having a chat in a pub, let's say, we might be more tolerant of what people are allowed to say. Whereas I think online, because the online world gives people a platform where they can reach potentially millions of people, it may well be that it is appropriate for us to have a slightly broader definition of what we don't think is acceptable online, particularly when we're talking about holding social media companies responsible. It may well be that we don't necessarily want to punish individuals for certain things they've said, but that doesn't mean that we want to give them a platform for saying those things. So what they might be saying may not be a criminal offence for them to say, but we might want to say that actually that should not be allowed to be published online.
Jennifer, if I may, to your question, because I would disagree with the premise, because for me, when we're training police officers and when we're training prosecutors, we talk about it being 5% content and not 5% context, and it's a glib comment, but it's really true. That I get accused of lots of things, normally Orwell kind of figures in it, but fascist often figures in it, and misogynistic or whatever people's sort of gripes because of the role I do. And I think there's an acceptability about using a set of language to me that there wouldn't be towards a 14-year-old trans child or a 17-year-old lad with learning disability. So I think context is really important, and hate crime is at its basis, and you three are all academics and I'm not, hate crime to its basics is an issue of power imbalance, and kind of that who is the speaker and what is the audience and what is the background and the context mean that we are never going to give a framework that says you can say X, but you can never say Y. Because I go back to the point earlier, the speech is not criminalised. The intention being the threat or the intention being the incitement is what's criminalised. Speech is the delivery mechanism of committing a core offence. So in a sense, it's never about the speech. It's always about the impact and about, for us, in terms of how we respond to it, it's rather than just when we criminalise it, it's about what is the harm caused by the speech. And that has got so many factors like a person's status, a person's position, the medium that's used, the target. So all of those things play out. So I just think it is never going to be possible to say, here is the line in the sand, don't step over that.
So how do people know what they can and can't say then? Because there's this principle of certainty that I need to know where what I can say and what I can't say, what's lawful and what's not. So, you know, what will have me in the local Garda station and what will have people saying that's unacceptable? Do you know what I mean? So contact, in terms of practice, sure. How do I know what I can and can't say?
We have another one of our clip lines that we sort of use on every interview with a press release after somebody's been convicted, which says that you shouldn't do online what you wouldn't do in front of a police officer in the street, because ultimately the law doesn't differentiate. The law applies online as offline. And we've got a few stated cases in the UK that help with defining things like jurisdiction, which have come out of the case of Shepherd and Whittle that went to the Supreme Court. But we've also got this issue that where the courts appear to have accepted that the internet is a public space. And kind of, so lots of the offences that we talk about were public order offences. So there's an element of the examples are contained within the legislation in general. So we would use that as an example. Well, the best indicator of is of how courts have interpreted offences that have been put before them. And unfortunately for us, most of the cases that we refer to as examples have only gone as far as the Magistrates Court and they've never been appealed. So we haven't got strict rulings. But when you look at the case, and I won't name names, but there's a case that for me that is really telling, which is perhaps the least vociferous of the language that I carry in the examples I would use. But because the person who was using it was a former BNP, British National Party councillor, and because of the forum that it was being delivered and the location it was being delivered, he was convicted of an offence of racially aggravated public order. So it's all about that context. And obviously one of the impacting factors was his position as a legitimate member of a legal political party at the time. So sorry that complicated more. Plus Cara's.
I wonder if I might come in there, because it's interesting when you said a moment ago, Paul, you know, you don't say something online that you wouldn't say in front of a police officer. But isn't it actually different? Isn't it different what you can say online and what you can say offline, both in terms of what's socially acceptable, but also what's legally permissible?
Because it's different, it's one of those context issues, isn't it? So the platform of kind of saying something in the street, up an alleyway where there's nobody within 200 yards, one of the context elements there is you're saying it when nobody's going to be offended and nobody's going to be harmed by it. If you're saying it online and you've got 6 followers, you may think you're fairly safe. But we've got examples where a man who abused Fabrice Muamba, the footballer, while he had a cardiac arrest playing football, he'd got, I think, 32 followers. But because somebody retweeted it because of the hashtags they used, suddenly millions and millions of people were reading the material. So there's a risk of the internet. But if you were up an alleyway and speaking with only your friend there who shared your views, then you're not likely to commit the public order offences. So it does make it is difficult, and it is one of those context issues, but it isn't, I would say, declaratory in one direction or another.
But my interpretation of it was that you could probably say a lot more online than you can say offline. And that the CPS policy kind of recognises that, doesn't it? That, you know, it has to really be in the public interest because there are millions of comments made online every day.
So the CPS context is talking about the malicious communications offence, isn't it? Whereas obviously there is still the public order and there's still the threats to kill and there's all those other offences as well which aren't covered by that guidance. So I think the difference for me in the pragmatic term is that when you do something online, you've provided a record of what you said, whereas obviously something said in the terrace of a football stadium or in a bar is subject to interpretation. So there is differences, but I don't particularly see them as say definitive to be plus or minus in a legal context.
Carl, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was just going to just say that I think. I suppose my comments are about what I think ought to be the case rather than what is currently the case. So I'm sort of thinking about this from first principles. And it's interesting what you said, Paul, about hate crime being about power. And I suppose that's what we're seeing online, that it's actually that power relationship might be inverted, actually, in the online world compared to the offline world, in the sense that quite often, for example, we've seen with a lot of misogynistic comments that quite often it's men who may feel threatened by some women who are in the public eye, who may well have quite a high position in society, but they might feel threatened by that, or other women might feel threatened by that, and those women get picked on. But also that we don't, the harm being caused by those comments, you know, you talked about context, and in the offline world, it does make a difference whether or not the person making a comment, for example, is a teacher as opposed to, you know, a child of 12. But in the online world, we don't know who that person is or what their position is. And so therefore, we're left with the words rather than necessarily some of that context that might help us understand whether this should be an offence. And so therefore, given that we don't have that context, what do we do? We then have to focus on the words themselves and decide whether the words themselves are ones that should be either A, punished, and or B, removed. And those two are separate things.
And what do you think, what differentiates them, Clara, punishment and removal?
The punishment is where you are criminalising that particular individual, where you're saying to that individual, you will suffer criminal sanctions for what you've done. Whereas if we're saying, look, we're just not, you know, we are Facebook, haha, and we're not going to let you, we're not going to let you use our platform to say that. You can go somewhere else, try somewhere else, or you can write it on the blog if you like, but we're not going to give you that platform that Facebook, for example, can give you. The individual is not suffering the same, is not suffering criminal consequences themselves.
And can I ask where do you draw the line then? Because there's, you know, criminal behavior or speech removal, kind of the private sanction, if you want, and then just left on the internet. So where do you draw the lines between those three? Or is it all about context?
Well, inevitably, you're going to end up having to, you know, if you're trying to set this in some kind of legislative format, you're going to end up having to come up with some kind of general wording, whether that be maliciousness or whether that be harmfulness or emotional distress or whatever it is. You are going to be left with some general phrase that could be like it is currently stirring up hatred, for example. Mm-hmm. That then has to be developed through the law to be clearer. Because I get this question asked a lot, where is the line? That it's not easy to say, you come up with a form of words and then it has to be interpreted. Mm-hmm. That's where possibly, and I don't know, maybe, you know, this is something that I'm thinking about, I don't really know yet whether this would work, but that's where potentially we do have to start coming up with concrete examples of what we think people can and can't say. And being more specific.
So from my context, if I may, because that obviously falls to me and colleagues in terms of the guidance that we get within kind of within England, Wales and Northern Ireland, the issue is there's occasions where it's actually easier to prosecute somebody than it is to remove the material. So So there was a case in 2015 of a man from the southwest of England who put up materials which he was deeply anti-Semitic. It was trying to promote a march through Golders Green, an area where there's a strong Orthodox Jewish community, and he was trying to arrange a march to go through on the Sabbath. And so he was prosecuted because he owned the website. We didn't have an intermediary to ask to take it down. So it actually sat there until his subscription ran out while he was in prison for an offence of inciting racial hatred. So to the other context, most of the removals are made by the companies, the intermediaries, under their terms of use, their community sort of standards. And we may ask for them to consider that. But to do so, we have to consider our duty under Article 10 not to interfere with persons' freedom of expression. And we can only do that as a state when we have an argument which says that we do so in a way which is proportionate, legal, achievable, and necessary. And that's the test. So what we don't do in our guidance, which is kind of publicly available on our True Vision website for anybody to see, what we don't do in the guidance is try to do that, what you just said, which is define the examples of what is and isn't appropriate, but to give them some examples of things that happen, but then give them the framework for them to make their decision, because they have to defend their intervention with a person's freedom of expression and not me. I have to defend the policy. They have to defend their individual actions. So we try to give officers the framework about when to intervene and when not to.
So I think what might be really helpful for some of our listeners is if we can just sort of rewind one step back and perhaps just outline what some of the laws are. So what are some of the current laws that we use to prosecute these individuals that disseminate hate online?
But there are a number of different offences that can be used, and of course you don't want the detail on that. Broadly speaking, we can one way of trying to understand the laws and to sort of categorise them in some way is to say that we have some offences that are kind of criminalising the speech directly, and then we have offences that are doing so indirectly. And that direct and indirect could also work with the sort of hate speech, hate crime divide. So we have the sort of direct way in which we might punish hateful speeches, where we have specific offences where you are criminalising speech that is hateful towards certain groups. And we have offences like that in the UK. We also have offences like that in Ireland. How often those are used and how successful they are is another issue, but they do exist. But there are other ways in which we can indirectly prosecute hate speech, and that's where somebody has committed some kind of crime. So it could be some kind of harassment offence, or it could even constitute assault in some situations, and where there is hostility of some sort, that can make that offence more serious. If there's hostility towards someone's race or religion, for example, that can make the offence more serious. We also have some offences that are specifically aimed at communications that occur electronically, which have effectively now been used for the online world. But again, those are not directly prosecuting hate, because hate is not part of the definition of the offence. So the kind of thing that is punished there is malicious communications, for example, which is a very broad term, which can include some hateful comments, but isn't exclusively about hate. So there's, broadly speaking, kind of direct and indirect ways in which we might prosecute.
Yeah, can I just pick up on that, Cara? Because so we have the Harassment, Harmful Communications and Related Offences Act 2020 here in Ireland. And, you know, the Section 4 of that is really, really broad. So it's a person who by any means distributes or publishes any threatening or grossly offensive communication about another person. And so what my question is, and I don't know if you have an answer, because there's nothing here on it yet from the courts, is racism de facto grossly offensive, or does it have to be, you know, grossly offensive communication with racism on top? Do you see what I'm trying to get at? So
yes.
Is one necessarily the other, or do you need both in order?
That's a really good question. I'll try and answer. I don't think I have an answer, but I can sort of think through what my initial response to that is. I guess partly the issue is also whether or not it's how we define racism, because of course how you define racism may itself mean that any comment that's racist is by definition also grossly offensive. But there must be a spectrum here, because it's grossly offensive. So there must be some comments that are purely offensive. And so there must be some racist comments that are offensive without being grossly offensive. I'm just sort of thinking about some of the racism that the footballers, the England footballers, suffered in the summer. Some of it involved things like banana emojis being sent to them. Now, something like that might be seen, it's clearly racist, but is it grossly offensive, considering some of the comments they received would have been really horrific? Maybe a banana emoji is offensive, but not grossly offensive. I mean, it's sort of not for me to say. It's really for the jury to decide. So it could well be that a jury decides that is grossly offensive. But
I might add just a couple of comments here, because I think from my experience working with the CPS and reading case law in this area is that the term grossly offensive is actually incredibly narrowly defined. Very, very few cases ever make it to court. And one of the reasons for that is that whether something is grossly offensive or not is determined based on whether a reasonable person would consider it to be grossly offensive. And it tends, and I might be overgeneralizing, but it tends to be a group of lawyers who will sit around in a room looking at a phrase, and they'll determine, would a reasonable person in a trial as a juror consider this to be grossly offensive? And so one of the leading cases, Collins, I'm sure Cara knows the case of Collins, where someone telephoned an MP and used the most grotesque racist language on an answer machine, including the M word, as well as other racist terms. And the court in that case, and correct me if I'm wrong, Cara, because I know this is more your area, decided that a reasonable person would not find that grossly offensive. And I think what happens is quite often racist terms or homophobic terms or identity-based hostility is really, really grossly offensive if you're from that identity group. And if you're not, and you are a reasonable person from the rest of society, it's always considered offensive, but not grossly offensive. And I think that's a real limitation, I think, in this area of law. I know the law's moved on a little bit, and it does say, look, a reasonable person from a particular community should be considered as well. But I do think that's a real limitation in this area of law.
What would be the alternative then? I guess we could try and come up with concrete examples, maybe, to help help the police or the lawyers or whoever it is that's making this decision, to help them try to understand what that line is. But then who's the one who gets to make up that list?
So I would just stress that it's not illegal to be racist, and it's not illegal to say racist things. It's the offences are committed through the incitement or through the causing harassment, alarm and distress, or threatening behaviour. So the example I always use is there are racist phrases within our normal language that is used in a commonplace where they're racist language, they're racist statements, but not necessarily intended in a racially harmful, derogatory way. So the one I always use with to express this is the phrases Dutch courage and going Dutch, which are clearly racist connotations that have historical derogatory intent behind them, talking about people from the Netherlands. But they're commonly accepted in modern language and often used in a way that is anywhere a million miles away from being intended to be harmful. So I think there has to be that acceptance that racism is an acceptable emotion, but it's also about the context. And if I, as a somebody who has got a responsibility of being involved in the policing of racism and hate crime, There is an expectation that my standard of language would be higher than somebody who drives a bus, who's got no public life, who kind of is just talking in a pub to friends. So I think, again, it goes back to that context, and it just makes it so much more difficult to do what you've asked us to define, which is draw the line in the sand. And I don't think we can ever get to that point where we can draw a line in the sand that says X is good and Y is bad.
Well, is that because it's impossible to draw a line in the sand, or is it because no matter where the line is, if you do draw a line, there's going to be thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, you know, or is it because if you communicate with your pal on Facebook Messenger, that's very different to if you have a million followers on Twitter and you said exactly the same thing. Do you see what I mean? I'm getting back to that idea of how do I know what I can say or what I can't say?
I think you probably need psychologists and anthropologists and all sorts of experts to talk about this, but there is that inbuilt sort of emotion historically in the human kind of psyche that says fear of people who are different is something that was there as a defense mechanism when you feared that the people from the next village were going to come and take your grain or take your family. So that emotion of having a fear of outsiders seems to be something that is historically inbred in the race that we are, and kind of it's about how the behavior is affected by that and whether people control that and whether it's hostile and whether it's offensive and whether it's damaging. So for me, it's always going to be about intent, and it goes back to that thing of if you're telling a young man standing alone at a bus stop, and you're a seven young strong men standing around him in a circle, that context then becomes something that would make a relatively mild statement become something which I would suggest would be potentially a criminal offence under the Public Order Act under them circumstances. And I think it's always going to be that issue about speaker, context, location, and intent.
I wonder what some of the answers might be then, if we could just sort of think about how the law is currently prescribed, and it's clearly unsatisfactory for a number of different reasons. What might be some of the answers? I know, Cara, you've put forward a few sort of your own ideas, haven't you, in this area?
Yeah, so I'm just thinking about what Jen was just saying. You know, how do I know what I can and can't say? And I wonder, I suppose maybe this is what I'm trying to get at a little bit with us treating the online world separately. At the moment, the way the legislation is set out, whether you say something online or offline, can make a difference in the sense that our Malicious Communications and Communications Act, they apply to the online world. But online can mean, you know, I've sent a message on WhatsApp to somebody versus I'm a public figure and I've got a million Twitter followers. So the current legislation is not making that distinction, and it might well be that we've got to have different standards, and we have that already in the offline world, because the Public Order Act, the whole point of the Public Order Act is that there are some things that you can say in private to your family or to your friends, but you just can't say to the outside world. That there's something about the public space and saying it in the public space that's the problem. And I think that we should take that distinction that we already have in the online offline world and apply that to the online world, so that it's not a question of what can and can't I say, it's where can I say anything I like. And actually, the minute I'm saying something on social media, I'm going to be more limited, even if I feel that that's unfair, even if it means that I feel that I don't have the freedom to say what I want on Instagram anymore. So be it.
Can I just add, Mark? I agree with what Cara was saying there. The distinction between private communications by email and private communications by Twitter, which is then available to anybody who kind of searches for the words or searches for you or searches for the subject, is obviously very different. And I would equate that to being in public and being in the private dwelling. I just take slight challenge with the question, which says that this isn't good enough, that what we have isn't good enough. I accept we're finding a way through this. This is a new medium which is affecting society, and we're finding a new way of defining social norms as well as legal kind of standards. But I actually think that having travelled the world sort of responding to post-conflict zones around the world. I really have a massive respect for the human rights framework under the European framework and the legislation that is obviously built around that, because what it doesn't do is seek to say the right is an absolute right. The only right to absolute life, I think, under the human rights framework is torture, isn't it? The right to be free from torture. All the others are conditional, and this is conditional. And what it doesn't seek to do is, in the way that some frameworks do around the world, is just to draw the line. And what it does is provides a balance. And your right to be protected from my view, which I have a legal right to hold, is your right. And it's a matter of the role of the courts, particularly under the European framework, is to decide whether my breach of your right was more important than your right to be protected from my speech. So I think that balancing rights against each other and finding what is an acceptable level of speech is for me the best framework I've seen anywhere in the world is under the human rights framework, and the interpretation that states like the UK has made historically over those within that framework, should I say.
Can I ask then, so we've dealt with the easy question of what the police and the courts are concerned with. What about that second tier then, where we're talking about regulation? So it's not criminal, but it's still, where we're asking platforms to remove speech that doesn't quite meet the threshold of criminality or isn't made in a particular context, but still isn't what we want on our public spaces, and I'm thinking particularly TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, these platforms. Carol, what do you think about that regulatory space then?
I mean, I'm actually very much in favour of it. I mean, we do need to police. I mean, in the UK, they're currently Parliament is considering setting up a new regulator who will have the power to impose quite big fines on social media companies for not removing hate. And I'm in favour of that. I don't feel. I know some people don't like it because they feel that's an infringement of their freedom of expression. But I think that increasingly we're beginning to understand the power that these social media companies have. And I think in 10 years' time, we'll be looking back and think we won't believe that we allow people free reign on these platforms. So I'm quite happy with it. I do think we need to be careful, once the codes of conduct come out, and, we will need to look at the detail of how those are going to be implemented by social media companies, who gets to decide whether or not they're doing their job properly. I think it's also worth thinking about proactive moderation. At the moment, the focus is very much on users highlighting problems to the companies and then removing material. It may well be that we have to think about proactive moderation where they stop things going up in the first place, or they seek out things themselves. But I absolutely think this is the way we need to go, not least because it's impossible for the police to police the internet without social media companies.
So we don't have a takedown notice in the way that there is under the Terrorism Act. So under the Terrorism Act, there can be a takedown notice to companies, and basically all we can do is invite them to consider it against their terms of reference. So it's their terms of use. So there is a distinct difference. I mean, there's obviously too much to be kind of controlled by the police anyway, and I don't think that's a primary police function that we would be positioned or kind of resourced to be able to do it. I think one of the issues for me is about there is two reasons why material is harmful. One is that it causes offence, damage, harm to the people who read it. And the other is about, does it have emotional, motivational impact on others to act out? So we've seen terrorists who've been so wound up by what they've been reading online that they've gone and committed atrocities. When we look at what Thomas Mayer was exposed to and shared in the years that led up to the tragic murder of Joe Cox, you can see that you can't say that made him do what he did, but you can see why that might have been harmful to him. The Southern Poverty Law Center in the US found links between, I think, over 100 racist murders in the US and one website called Stormfront, which claims to be one of the longest running websites in existence. Now, Stormfront used to be in a dark and seedy corner of the internet where the public weren't exposed to, because you had to work really hard to get in. So the only people who really saw the material, which was vile, really, really vile, the only people who saw it were either like-minded individuals or people who were trying to see what like-minded individuals were getting up to. So it tended to be law enforcement or white supremacists. But it, given that there's this link which you probably couldn't prove was a causal link between that and 100 murders, then clearly it was harmful to the motivation of people who've got a propensity to racist violence to act out violently. So for me, that you have to look at each in its own right. So clearly the one with 2 million followers is going to be more damaging to society for what would perhaps be a less vociferous comment than somebody in that darkened room in the seedy corner of the internet. So for me, the kind of what we need is a social standard. When I used to go to the football club I support as a teenager, the racist language was absolutely commonplace, and now it isn't, and it's not the law that's changed that, it's the social standards accepted by the crowd. And what we need is those social norms to be defined by its users as well as the intermediaries, but the intermediaries need to take their social responsibility in using, as Cara said, the setting the algorithms that allow this material not to be shared and not to be prioritized and not to be delivered to those who it seeks to offend and seeks to harm. So for me, it's they have a lot more work to do to play their part. But I'm not sure it's for the police to be telling them when to press the delete button.
I wonder if I could challenge you on that, because I wonder if it is the police's role, actually. It's the state's role rather than companies' roles to be determining what's socially acceptable or not. So are we not, if we create a framework where we can fine companies if they don't take down hateful content, aren't we just passing the buck? We're saying, okay, we don't really know what hateful conduct is. We don't really know when it's illegal. So what we're going to do is going to ask companies to determine what's illegal, which lawyers can't even work out themselves. And if not, can you also work out what hateful content is versus what free speech is, and also take that down? And if you don't take it down, we're going to fine you.
So I think it's both. I don't think it's us abdicating kind of our responsibility in this, because we clearly do have a responsibility in terms of the criminal law. If I can just give you one example, one of the problems obviously is some of them outside our jurisdiction. So the internet is obviously a global platform and we've got national legislation. But there was a really fantastic scheme put together by one of the New York newspapers where they said that they didn't want to take comments away from the comment sections, but what they did is put a tiering system in where real name validated accounts always sat above unvalidated accounts. So the hate material was on there, but it was on page 453 or of kind of 500 comments, and they knew that from their kind of analysis of their site is that people only read the first page of comments and occasionally the second page. So they weren't taking away the right to speech, they weren't interfering with the free speech, but they were reducing the harm by not exposing people to it. One of the fear of the with around some of the social media companies is their algorithms actually promote the material that has the most reaction, and that reaction can be vitriolic objection to it by good people who are opposing the material, and by challenging it, they're actually raising it up the algorithm. So those are for me the kind of key parts, but ultimately they have to accept what's on their space in the way that the editor of the Times would have decided which of the million letters that they got on an average day they actually published in the paper. And for me it's the same. Sorry, Cara.
No, not at all. No, absolutely. I was just going to say, I completely agree with Mark. I don't think we should be giving the role to social media companies, but I don't think that's what's being proposed here with the regulator, because that's what we're doing at the moment, because the social media companies are reacting to what they see as their audience's need for cleaner internet, but they're doing it according to what they think is the right. You know, the right framework. The point of the regulator is that it is the regulator, i.e. the state or this independent body that represents the state that will be telling them this is the kind of material, giving them the rules so that they've got to fit their algorithms around what the regulator tells them is or isn't allowed. So I entirely agree with you. We shouldn't be allowing them to decide. But I think paradoxically, without the regulator, we are allowing them to decide.
Okay, yeah, that's really actually really helpful for clarifying. And I think just probably because we're coming up to time now, a last point then is just going back to this idea of automation algorithms and what they can do. I mean, is this really kind of where we're going in terms of the key solution? Technology, is technology the solution to combating online hate? And I wonder, Paul, you know, as you're the lead on the National Online Hate Crime Hub, where are we at with this? How far have we got in terms of how effective is this technology in identifying and potentially taking hate down?
So it's emerging, I guess, is the understanding. So we've got sort of partnerships with organisations who are doing kind of work to analyse the hate at the macro level, if you like. So not as an investigation tool, but just to kind of measure which subjects attract the most vitriol on which platforms. For me, kind of one of the platforms, sort of one of the tactics that I think would be really useful for the platforms is we know that Jewish MPs, and particularly Jewish female MPs, historically have had a horrific abuse online, which will be misogynistic and racist and kind of any other kind of hostility that you can think of. So kind of giving an option for one of those MPs to kind of come off Twitter or to kind of go private or to block people isn't acceptable to somebody whose life is obviously about engaging with the community that they serve, and the internet is obviously the vehicle that's most commonly used for that. But having a situation where you offer them the choice of a level of protection that their at address will never appear in a 140 carry or 280 character message that includes one of the words that we know would be used in the vitriolic anti-Semitism that they suffer, giving them the option to have their name removed from a site that has got a kind of hateful anti-Semitic name seems to be one of the technical solutions that could come as source, so they actually never appear and they're never causing the offence. And you if you use that victim as part of that decision-making process and say, we can give you this option, here we give you the information so they make the decision with their eyes quite open in an informed way. Those are the sort of technical solutions that can problem solve that mean that none of us are making these decisions because the material isn't getting there in that format. So for me, there is a whole bunch of technical solutions that, and I think they have a huge role to play, whether that's kind of broadly seen as setting the standard for the platform that they want and having it set the way they want and not to accept the people they don't want, or whether it's kind of working with partners such as the police and victims groups to find kind of different technical solutions to the same problem. But they have all the tools and they have the expertise, they have the knowledge. But I think they're different platforms are in different places, but they're all behind the curve, I would suggest.
Harry, did you have anything you wanted to add there?
I guess Paul knows far more about the detail of this, but it's quite clear from the Facebook revelations this week that Facebook actually know how to promote material, so therefore also know how to suppress material, but they choose not to. So I think it's definitely about the technology, but it's also about us forcing them to be transparent about their algorithms so that we know how these things are working, and that inevitably there's going to have to be some kind of human moderation involved as well. There's going to have to be a layer of human intervention, but technology is going to play a massive part in us trying to deal with this. I think it's inevitable.
And of course, the emotional labor for the humans who are doing that moderation is really, really significant. I feel that with every podcast, rather than presenting solutions to how to address hate crime on the two islands, we are perhaps producing more questions than answers. But this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I've learned so much, and it's such a delicate area, isn't it? And as somebody who grew up as you know, who learned about the internet. I won't say what age I was. But, you know, I think I wonder, are there generational differences as well between kind of digital natives, as we call them, and those of us who you know, remember the first iPhone, remember when Twitter came online. But thank you both so much. Mark, did you want to say anything?
No, just to say thank you so much to both of you. Really insightful. And I hope our listeners will find it incredibly helpful as well.
Hate Crime on the Two Islands is a podcast funded by the European Centre for the Study of Hate at the University of Limerick, written by Mark Walters and Jennifer Schwepp, and produced by Mark Walters, Jennifer Schwepp, and Kate O'Donovan.